From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Boy, if you get a moment to get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the feature article that Lex has posted, The Playful Apparition. Really interesting video shot by the After Dark Paranormal Investigations Group of Louisville, Kentucky. It was posted on the website of a television station there, WAVE, Channel 3. Team's camera set up in a cemetery. They believe the ghost is that of a little girl. Go take a look at that. Fascinating stuff. It's going to be a fascinating program indeed. Well, some of the news of the day in Riverside, California, not too far from where we are when we're in Los Angeles. Authorities filed murder and arson charges carrying the death penalty against a man suspected of setting a Southern California wildfire last week that killed five firefighters. A suspect, Raymond Lee Eilier, 36 years old, already under arrest on suspicion of setting two other wildfires over the summer. This blaze was the deadliest for firefighters since 14 were killed in July of 1994 in Colorado. In Columbia, South Carolina, police found bodies of three adults inside a large drainage pipe near a public housing complex this morning. They say all appear to have been killed overnight. And also in South Carolina, a 23-year-old man who police say tried to dig up the grave of a 12-year-old girl after seeing her picture in an obituary, he has been sentenced to 20 years in prison. His name is Byron Nicholas Garcia. He never did find the girl's grave. He told investigators he wanted to take her home. Big story breaking, of course. Diebold Inc., that's the electronic voting company, has insisted that the cable network HBO cancel a documentary that questions the integrity of its voting machines, calling the program inaccurate and unfair. HBO is going to go ahead with Hacking Democracy. The program Hacking Democracy debuted on Thursday. The film claims that Diebold voting machines aren't tamper-proof and can be manipulated to change voting results. So it's very interesting. A mother-to-be had her fears eased when one of her triplets gave her the thumbs up during a scan while still in the womb. Donna Ryder from England was rushed to a hospital with stomach cramps. She was sent out for a scan. She said before the scan, she didn't know what she was expecting, especially triplets. She said, I got a shock. I could clearly see one of the triplets giving me the thumbs up from the womb. It was so clear and unbelievable, but I knew that all would be all right. Isn't that amazing? Tom Cruise, the Hollywood superstar who was dumped in August by Paramount Studios, has been named to run United Artists, the film studio founded nearly 90 years ago by Hollywood legends Charlie Chaplin and Mary Pickford. Cruise and business partner Paula Wagner, who will serve as chief executive of the company, will join Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, MGM, in the deal that includes Cruise appearing in and producing United Artists films. You know, as Richard C. Hoagland has been talking with us about the missing NASA tapes from Apollo 11, well, some of them have been found, 100 of them. For years, lost tapes recording data from the Apollo 11 moon landing have been stored underneath the seats of Australian physics students, according to a research study that has uncovered them. Nobody knew this. They were nearly thrown out with the rubbish, but a last-minute search instead has scientists in Western Australia dusting off several boxes of the lost NASA tapes, which record surface conditions on the moon, just after Neil Armstrong stepped into space history on July 21st of 1969. Last week, up to 100 tapes, clearly marked NASA Manned Space Center, turned up after a search in a dusty basement of a physics lecture hall at Curtin University of Technology in Perth, Western Australia. One of the old tapes has been sent to the American Space Agency, NASA, to see whether it can be deciphered and stripped of any important data which may have survived the ravages of time. In a moment, Robert Farrell joins us. His new book called Alien Log. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Robert Farrell received his Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering from The Ohio State University and his MBA from Western New England College and his Doctor of Engineering from the University of Massachusetts. For most of his life, Dr. Farrell has been interested in ufology. Over 10 years ago, he began doing serious research for his novel, Alien Log. His book is unique in that it offers all of us a nuts and bolts approach encompassing many aspects of ufology. Since retiring from Penn State University, Dr. Farrell and his wife live in Peoria, Arizona, where he is now working on another series of stories, including a sequel to Alien Log. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast. Robert, how are you?
Very good, George. How are you?
Good, good. It was nice meeting you at one of the conferences not too long ago. You are a distinguished gentleman, my friend.
Well, thank you very much. So are you.
Interesting story, Alien Log, though it's a novel, it's based on a lot of fact and truth. Tell me how you got interested in this field.
Well, I got interested when I formed a logical conclusion that there were aliens, and, you know, I can't say exactly when that occurred in my life, but, you know, you look up in the sky and you wonder, are we alone? And so I just concluded that we weren't, and it was a logical process, I think probably very similar to what the famous scientist Enrico Fermi went through when he came to the same conclusion. You know, if you look at in the universe, it's been estimated there's like 100 billion galaxies and on average 200 billion stars in each one. So if you do the math, you come up with two with 22 zeros after it. That's a lot of stars. And a lot of those stars are similar to our sun. And in our own galaxy of about 300 billion stars, There are whole ranges of stars similar to our sun. Our sun, by the way, is a second-generation star whose lifespan is on the order of 10 billion years. And we have evidence that some of those stars have already reached the end of their life. And you can, if you have a telescope, you can find areas where there are stars like our sun just now being born. So, and our sun is halfway through its life of about 5 billion years.
So you're going on probability, Robert. You're going on mathematics, statistics that would say because of this, we should have that. And you know what? I tend to agree with you there.
Right. And because of the age of our sun, which is kind of in the middle of our class of stars, the probability is then that there are stars like our sun that would have planets capable of having life that could be millions, perhaps billions of years older than our sun. And if there's life there, that it would probably be much more advanced than us and have technology far superior to ours. You know, it's hard to imagine what can happen with technology even 1,000 years from now, let alone 1 million or 1 billion years. So certainly they have the technology to be wandering through our galaxy, and they're probably visiting us from time to time. And I think that's the same logic that Fermi followed. And that created a paradox for him. His paradox was, well, so where is everybody, you know? If they're out there, where are they? And my belief is they're here. And that's evidenced by at least 100 sightings a week just in the U.S. And over the years, we've accumulated tens of thousands of sightings by trained observers, credible witnesses. So the evidence is there, in my opinion. A lot of people are looking for hard evidence. I think in the form of testimony, there's a wealth of evidence that the aliens do exist and that they're here visiting us now.
Here you are, Robert, extremely degreed. You know, you've got your Bachelor of Science degree, you've got an MBA, you've got your Doctor of Engineering. Is science getting close to finding definitive proof of extraterrestrial life? And in my definition, by the way, of definitive proof would be for us to actually see the craft or remnants of a craft, even though some of it may be confiscated now, may be held by governments. But I mean, for the public to see this, do you think science is getting close enough where we're going to see this kind of proof?
I think so. I think the first step is to just demonstrate that there is life beyond Earth. And I think the probes that we've sent to Mars are getting close to yielding up some hard evidence that there was life there, with some amazing photographs that are coming back from the surface of Mars. That some of the photographs that were taken look remarkably like seashells. I don't know if you've seen those.
Yes, I've seen those. They do. And as a matter of fact, I had a report last week that said that the landers that landed 30 some years ago on Mars basically didn't have the capability of determining that there was a biological life there. And people are beginning to wonder now that there may be biological life in the soil there
right.
on Mars.
Right. Well, the life that we may be seeing now, and I look at those shells and I say, well, that's evidence there was life there. All the requirements for life are there. Some of the photographs show evidence that there's water ice in some of the craters. There's evidence that there are areas where water has flowed recently in the last few years. So you have the right ingredients for life. And now that we have a satellite in orbit that will have the ability to penetrate the surface and look for subterranean water, I think once we find pockets of subterranean water, if we ever have the capability to go there and bore into that water, we might find there's life there today.
Robert, your work in Alien Log talks about the ancient Sumerian culture, what they knew thousands of years ago. Let's talk a little bit about that. That has always fascinated me. A lot of this knowledge, for me, gathered from the work of Zachariah Sitchin. How about you?
Yes, same for me. I know some people question him. I think he makes sense. You know, on the bottom line, you read a lot of stuff by a lot of different people, and you sort it out. And you have to pick what makes sense to you. And I think what he says makes a lot of sense. It fits the overall picture of things. One of the reasons I began looking at his work and the Sumerians was because when I was writing my book, it was important for me to figure out whether the aliens were going to be benevolent or not. And so according to Sitchin, the aliens actually came here 450,000 years ago and actually created us. And if that's true, then why would they want to destroy us? So that helped me, you know, logically conclude that, okay, they're not here to destroy us because actually they created us. And, of course, another logical argument you could make is that with their technology, they could destroy us anytime they wanted to, and they haven't yet, so apparently they don't want to.
I think it's fascinating how the myths, the stories, and some of the things we see in ancient texts or tablets shows that there were some very strange things going on here a long time ago. How the Greeks talk about all their gods, and if you equate them with visitations, they all make sense.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Sumerians are unique in that they existed about 6,000 years ago in the area that we would now call Iraq, but the amazing thing is that suddenly out of nowhere, there was no transition. It was like a quantum jump from nothing to all of these inventions like writing, medicine, law, mathematics, astronomy. And they had knowledge that it's hard to explain how they could have come by it. For instance, their belief that there was this planet Nibiru that wandered into the influence of our sun and actually became a planet of our sun. And Nibiru had some moons, according to the Sumerians. Well, a lot of people would find that fact alone to be hard to believe because a planet that wanders around without a sun is kind of difficult to fathom. But actually, that's very believable because just recently they've discovered what I call planetoids. A planetoid, by the way, in my opinion and my definition, would be if when gas and debris is collapsing to form what would normally be a second-generation star. If the mass was not large enough, and typically astronomers would say if it was less than 13 times the mass of Jupiter, that it wouldn't be large enough to cause fusion. And so, therefore, it would become either a brown dwarf or even smaller. And I call it a planetoid. And it would not necessarily have, it wouldn't have a sun, actually. It would form all by itself. And as it collapsed, if the cloud of debris that's collapsing has angular momentum, that would be conserved, and you'd have a planetary disk form around that planetoid, and out of that disk you would have moons. So it's certainly believable that there could be a thing called a planetoid with moons that is formed without a star that would then wander around the galaxy and eventually perhaps get caught up by a star. And the characteristic of that would be that it would enter an orbit into that sun or star, and it would be an elongated orbit. It would be out of the ecliptic. The ecliptic is the plane that the native planets are going in. So it would probably be out of the ecliptic, and there's a 50-50 chance that it would go retrograde, backwards. Well, according to the Sumerians, that's exactly what Nibiru was. It went into an elongated orbit with a period of 3,600 years, and it was retrograde, and it was about 30 degrees out of the ecliptic. And according to the Sumerians, as it made its passes around the sun, it would periodically interact with the planets. So they knew about Uranus and Neptune, and I guess on one of the passes, it interacted with Uranus and tipped it 90 degrees on its axis, according to the Sumerians. And later on, when it interacted with Saturn, at that time Saturn had a large moon, and it threw that out of orbit, and that became Pluto.
Ah, okay.
And then it went as close to the sun as what we call the asteroid belt today. And this all happened, by the way, 4 billion years ago. So at that time, the planets were very hot and plastic.
Right.
But when it got into the asteroid belt area, on one of its passes, it came close to a planet that existed there called Tiamat, which was about twice the size of the Earth. And in, Nibiru's moons interacted and actually crashed into Tiamat, eventually forming the asteroid belt with one half of that mass. And the other half, with a large moon that it had, was sent down to a lower orbit where Earth and the moon is today.
You know, when I was a kid, Robert, I believed that some planet exploded between Mars and Jupiter, creating the asteroid belt. Don't ask me why I felt that way, but I just did.
Well, it's interesting because if they count up all the pieces that's in the asteroid belt today, they figure that there's only half as much material as should be there. And so if you look at the Sumerian understanding of the solar system, it answers a lot of questions. First of all, the amazing thing is that they knew about Uranus and Neptune and that Uranus was tipped 90 degrees on its axis. We didn't know that till 1986 when we
That's
did the flyby.
Good point.
Another thing is astronomers have been arguing about whether Pluto was a planet or a cast-off moon from the outer planets. And according to the Sumerians, it was a cast-off moon.
Well, we know it's not a planet anymore.
Well, I know. It's not. They redefined it, but it used to be. And another thing that that is hard to explain other than by the Sumerian model is why does the Earth have so much water? But given its location relative to the Earth, it should be a more rocky planet. So astronomers are trying to look at different schemes as to how we could have acquired so much water. On the other hand, if indeed the Sumerians were correct, and the Earth formed further out in the area of the asteroid belt, it would be a more watery planet. In fact, Ceres, which is the largest asteroid out there, has just recently been found to be 25% water ice. So the Sumerian model fits the data so well that it's truly amazing. And another thing is their belief in how humanity was created, which is also truly amazing because they seem to be correct there, too. According to the Sumerians, this planet Nibiru had inhabitants that descended to the Earth 450,000 years ago for the purpose of mining minerals. They set up bases around the planet. One of them was in Africa. And the people that ran, the Anunnaki, they were called, who ran that base, came up with this clever idea of taking the Homo erectus, who existed at that time in that location, and the genetically modifying and combining some of their own genetic materials to create a more intelligent being with the ability to speak.
And they wanted workers, didn't they?
They needed workers, and according to the Sumerians, this was about 200,000 years ago in Africa. Well, the amazing thing is, in 1986, some genetics researchers from the University of California in Berkeley published a paper in the Journal of Science, which is very prestigious, and they had done a study. They had collected placenta, 147 placenta from around the world, and by doing a mitochondrial DNA study, they had worked backwards and determined that the first human appeared in Africa 200,000 years ago.
Exactly. Isn't that ironic?
Yeah. So that's quite amazing. Now, some people say, well, okay, that paper is correct. Adam and Eve did appear in Africa, but it was 5,000 years ago, at least according to the Bible. Well, guess what? Some more scientists from UC Berkeley in 2003 published a paper in Nature, which is another prestigious journal, and they had found bone fragments near Ethiopia. They were determined to be Homo sapien, and they were dated to be 160,000 years old.
Hey, Robert, stay with us. We'll pick up on that and also get your take on why someone like Klaatu, the day the Earth stood still, hasn't merely landed on the White House lawn. We'll be back in a moment. We'll also open up phone lines for you because tonight we've got a UFO extravaganza for you each hour until we get to the last hour, and that will be special open lines for you. I'll be back. And next hour, Jim Mars, Alien Agenda, joins us for our UFO extravaganza, so don't go anywhere. I am so delighted that we are giving out two free CDs with the After Dark newsletter subscription. These are classic Malachi Martin interviews, one we gave out a couple of years ago with an After Dark subscription. We're giving that out again, but we found another one, and this is a classic. So there'll be two separate programs when you subscribe to After Dark by calling 1-888-727-5505, or you can go online at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, your phone calls and more of our discussion with Dr. Robert Farrell, the Alien Log on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, because of your very strong engineering background, can you give us your hypothesis on how these UFOs get here, how they work?
Yes. That was one of the first things I had to sort out for myself. I happen to believe that they have developed what I call gravity drive. In other words, they've learned how to create or manipulate gravitational fields. And I came to that conclusion by fitting the data, and the data being observations by trained observers, hundreds of different observations. If you look at some of the characteristics of their flight, for instance, 100G accelerations, near right angle turns, and a bunch of other phenomena that if you look at that and you say, okay, now what scenario for a drive system best fits that data? And gravity drive fits it the best of any. And I'm not alone in concluding that. Of course, a long time ago, back in 1947, Hermann Oberth was commissioned to study that issue, and that was his conclusion. So I think gravity probably is the only drive system that can explain the 100G acceleration and right-angle turns without harming the occupants. And I give a lecture on this, and probably the best way to explain how gravity drive answers that question is to do what I call a thought experiment. If, for instance, you were to jump out of an airplane, you would fall toward the earth. You would be free-falling. You would feel weightless other than air resistance, but yet you're accelerating at 1G. Well, if you did that on Jupiter, you might be accelerating at 30 Gs, and if it was a bigger planet, it might be 100 Gs, but you have no sensation of the acceleration. You're free-falling. So if you have the ability to create a gravitational field in front of you or wherever, you would free-fall in that direction, and if you pointed the field in another direction, you would turn in that direction, but you would have no sensation of accelerating.
How would this free fall through you know, basically anti-gravity,
right,
how would that explain traveling through the, you know, so many millions of light years from point A to point B?
Well, if you had the ability to accelerate at, let's say, 1,000 Gs, even 100 Gs, but 1,000 Gs, because that would be no more harm to you than 100 Gs or 10 Gs or 1 G, you could accelerate up to near light speed very quickly. And at that point, time dilation kicks in. And so for you, traveling these long distances would seem like a very short period of time. And, of course, the interesting thing is if you were to use this machine and fly out to a star that's, let's say, 1,000 light years out,
right,
it might, to you, it might take you a few days. And then, let's say, you turn around and come back. Well, when you get back to the Earth, you now have gone into the future 2,000 years. So you've actually done sort of time travel. Of course, all your friends are dead. And that's one of the problems is if you're going to travel great distances, probably not a good idea to plan on going back and meeting your friends because they probably won't be there.
Unless there's something else going on, Robert, in addition to that theory, that somehow time stops when they do this. So they do go and come back, and maybe it is 2,000 of our years, but time stands still on this planet, where maybe it was just a few seconds. Possible?
That I don't know. You know, I try to stay with traditional engineering and science. I don't go much beyond Einstein in what he predicted. And I think, in my mind anyway, I can pretty well explain all of this. I know there's a discussion in my book about these aliens who are traveling long distances. And you know, first of all, they're well advanced, well beyond our technology. And I believe that if you could imagine just our own society 1,000 years from now, when we have all of our needs met, all the energy, our clothing, food, shelter, all those needs are met, eventually you get to a point where, okay, what do we do for excitement? Well, you know, the rich people years ago used to
travel.
Go on safari. So you might just pack up your whole neighborhood on this huge ship and just go on a safari with no intention of ever returning home. I mean, that's certainly possible. And then you don't worry about the fact that when you get home, it's a different planet.
That's a good point. Let's take some calls, and we'll talk about Alien Log before you sign off on our log tonight, this hour. Let's go to our East of the Rockies. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. My name is Angela, and I'm calling from Tacoma, Washington.
Hey, hello, Angela.
Go ahead. Hi. I have a good question. I've witnessed, like, UFOs before, and I do have a rare condition in my right eye. And I've talked to some people that have witnessed them also, and they also have a rare condition in their right eye. And are they here for some kind of medical, or could it be an eye condition? And what are these people that witnessed these UFOs?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. My take on why they're here is, first of all, they've been here for thousands of years, and they're sort of watching over us and watching over our planet. But there are other aliens also. If you can come to a logical conclusion that there's one alien race visiting us, you could easily come to a conclusion there could be hundreds or thousands. So I don't know what they're all up to. But I think the ones that have interacted with this mostly are sort of our guardians, if you will, watching over us and watching over the planet. A lot of things I think they do, like during abductions, may be to actually benefit us. And this business of hybrids is a whole other issue as to why they're creating hybrids, but that seems to be a phenomenon that is occurring.
And as you know, David Jacobs believes that there's something evil going on here, Robert.
Yes, I know that. His very last paragraph in his book states that he has this feeling of remorse. And I had an opportunity to ask him why he felt that way. And his feeling was, he said, well, whenever a more advanced society takes over a less advanced, the less advanced society disappears. And I think his fear is that these hybrids or the aliens eventually will interact with us, and because they are so far advanced, that we will just eventually fade away. And I think that's one of his fears.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. Good morning.
Good morning, George. This question, I don't know whether it's esoteric or rhetoric, is kind of two-part. Number one, I do believe in a probability of alien life, but all these sightings always seem to take place like 50 miles outside of Springfield, Missouri, or someplace of that nature. Why don't they just land a plane or whatever they're flying right in the middle of LAX or LaGuardia and say, hey, we're here, deal with it? And number two, don't you think that if they were peaceful, that would unite the Earth into saying, hey, look, let's quit our petty squabbling and really realize how primitive we are?
Well, good point, too. Go ahead.
My answer to that question is, I think disclosure will occur, and I believe it'll be in my lifetime, and it'll be when they want it to occur and on their terms, whether they land on the White House lawn or whatever it is. But I think they're wise enough to know that process is going to take a while. We have to be desensitized. There are a lot of people that would panic if they landed on the White House lawn, I think. We are becoming more and more less sensitive to that as the general populace, I think, due to the media. There's a lot of programs now that talk about the possibility of alien life. There are more books out. And strange as it may seem, actually, I felt that writing my book was part of that process. I actually felt compelled to write that book, Alien Log, as part of the process to get the general populace to read about aliens. And because of the information that I give out in that book, hopefully they will begin to say to themselves, well, you know, this all makes sense. I think it's possible. I think there might be aliens. And I think it's that type of process that has to take place first. I think it is occurring. I think that's what they're doing. And when they, and I agree, maybe when they do finally begin to interact with us, that there'll be some improvements in the way we do things, especially toward our environment, and perhaps in other areas.
Robert, how do you get the book, Alien Log?
Well, you can get it many ways. You can go to a bookstore, and if they don't have it on the stock, they can order it and get it in just a few days. You can go on the Internet, get it from Amazon or Barnes & Noble through their website. Or you can go to our website, Alien Log, that's one word, Alien Log, and download an order form. So there's different ways you can get it.
Sure. And that's alienlog.com?
Yes, www.alienlog.com.
West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Hi, George and Robert. How you doing?
Good.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. This is Karen from the Low Valley of Sacramento, and I had a question about Sumerians. I hear all the time about the Sumerians and their information, but I don't know who they are, when they existed, what their writing was. I mean, I've heard of Assyrians and Babylonians, but who are the Sumerians?
Well, the Sumerians actually predated the Babylonians and the Akkadians and the Assyrians. In fact, a lot of what we know about the Sumerians is through the writings of the Babylonians and the Akkadians. The Sumerians, their culture thrived about 6,000 years ago, so they're one of the very early ones, in fact, probably the earliest that we know about yet. And then that was followed by the Babylonian and Akkadians.
Hmm, okay.
But they all existed in what we now call Iraq.
Yeah, they are the early day Iraqis, I guess, right?
Okay. Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
All right, okay. Karen, thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program. Were some of the Sumerians, Robert, the Anunnaki? I mean, were they all intermixed, or are we talking about the Sumerians being Earthlings only?
Well, I look at the Sumerians as being humans. The Anunnaki were the aliens that came down from Nibiru. They were worshipped as gods by the Sumerians, and I don't know that they actually interacted directly with the Sumerians. Could have been perhaps because they had some kind of a repulsive appearance, and so I don't know that they interacted directly with the humans that they had created. So the Sumerians were humans. The Anunnaki were their gods. And according to the king's list before the deluge, that the world, if you will, was ruled by the Anunnaki. And then, of course, after the deluge, the first kingship occurred in a town called Kish, which is south of present-day Baghdad.
Do you believe the Anunnaki were giants?
They could well have been. Who knows? But, I mean, I think they were described as giants, so I'm not sure what they were. They could have been giants. They could have been reptilian forms. They might have been repulsive. I don't really know. But they apparently had the ability to live very long lives. According to the king's list before the deluge, there were just eight kings that ruled, and the one that ruled the longest ruled for what would have amount to about 42,000 years, I think, something unbelievable. But you have to put that in perspective, because they probably were not human. And, you know, if we looked at fruit flies today, for instance, they only live 14 or 15 days. And I'm sure they must think of us as some kind of god, if they could think, that we live forever, because we live 1,700 times longer than they do. And if there was a creature that lived 1,700 times longer than we do, that would be 120,000 years. And my feeling is that any alien life form that has that kind of technology probably lives as long as they want.
All right, Wild Card Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast with Dr. Robert Farrell. Hi there.
Hey, George, Robert. My name's Robert. You know, I just have a quick comment. Human beings have only been here a few million years, and, you know, we've come, you know, fairly far. And the reptile world was here 165 million years, and they didn't produce any intelligent life forms at all. It seems kind of hard for me to believe.
Good point, Robert. I like that. Go ahead, Robert.
Yes, well, the Anunnaki may have been reptilian. And people who have been abducted frequently report that some of their abductors, some of the aliens who abducted them, were of a reptilian form. So just because we aren't reptilian doesn't mean that there isn't some reptilian form with a higher intelligence that's possible.
Well, then if they genetically altered us, they probably gave us the warlike factor, huh?
Possibly. If they were warlike, we might have inherited that.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Georgie, Aurora, Indiana.
Hello, Georgie.
Well, I've had a theory that I've considered for a long time.
And what might that be?
Their drive is telekinetic. It's by the power of the mind and also their communication over great distances.
Explain a little bit more, Georgie.
Well, I've heard it said that there that some of the aliens that were supposed to be in Roswell, that they had headbands. And that could have been to enhance their already mental abilities. And it's like, okay, they talk about people when they're astral projecting, that they are there immediately. So imagine if you could take and project a ship across the universe with the power of your mind.
What do you think of that theory, Robert?
Well, of course, that would open up a lot of possibilities. I have to say, I tried to stay with a more nuts and bolts approach in my understanding of what's going on. And so, like I said, gravity drive fits the picture best for me. Time dilation kind of answers a lot of questions. The ability to travel through dimensions, I haven't quite resolved that in my own mind yet. I'm not saying it is impossible because I don't know. But if I can explain things without having to invoke that, I try to do that. And as far as the power of the mind, I think we're just beginning to discover its powers. And this telekinesis capability certainly is possible. I think it has to be proven yet, at least by a few scientists. So I don't know. You know, they might have that capability. They can apparently do some very strange things, like come through walls and transport people up through ceilings and through walls. And so how do you explain that? Well, just because you can't explain it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. So I tell you, as I've gotten deeper and deeper into this whole subject, I've opened my mind more and more to other possibilities. I don't exclude anything. There's some things I put onto the sideline and I say, well, I don't know quite yet if that makes sense, but I'm just going to hold on to it because maybe when I get more information, that will make sense.
You know what I can't understand, though, Robert, is the crashes we've heard about. How these craft with this incredible technology could just crash, that I don't understand.
Right. Well, of course, that's a good question. You got to believe that if they've got a million year more advanced technology than us, that they would know how to build craft that don't crash. And, of course, the first answer that comes to people's mind is that it was built by the lowest bidder. Well, I don't know if that's true. I think that because, again, here's where gravity drive answers another question. If they have gravity drive, and I happen to think that the way they develop the gravitational fields is by manipulating electromagnetic fields, and the relationship between electromagnetic fields and gravitational fields has been established by Einstein, so that's a fact.
Robert, we're running out of time. I'd love to get your answer, so I'm going to have to get you back for a full show, my friend, all right?
Oh, sure. Glad to.
We'll do that. Robert Farrell, Alien Log, his website, alienlog.com. They've got links up on our coasttocoastam.com website. In a moment, our UFO extravaganza continues with the alien agenda and Jim Mars right here on Coast to Coast AM.